Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You probably missed this unless you were trolling California state court filings last week, but the bank has foreclosed on the Sheraton Hotel in Stockton, California. I don't know if that counts toward today's figures that say Stockton has the highest foreclosure rate in the country, but it's a pretty good indicator of how deep the housing mess does go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarks and Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Friday, the 25th of July, and it's great to have you here. You know, Stockton's not a bad place. Officials there didn't do anything to make it number one on the foreclosure list. But number one it is. The research firm RealtyTrack said so this morning. Overall, the number of foreclosure proceedings in this country has more than doubled in the past year. In Stockton, that's one of every 25 homes. Bob Bersani is the interim housing director for the city. Mr. Bersani, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What happened to get the Stockton housing market where it is today?
We were a high-growth area for the last 4 or 5 years, just in terms of housing availability of land, and also housing prices being more affordable relative to some of the neighboring areas, such as the Bay Area.
People working in San Francisco and making that commute from Stockton. Hmm?
The Bay Area to Central Valley commute is very heavy. You know, it's been estimated that there are about 70 to 80,000 people making the commute from our area over to locations in the Bay Area for that purpose.
When did you know something was wrong with housing in your city?
I think many people in the housing industry had a sense just with the type of loan products that were being offered to people. I think the handwriting was on the wall that as these interest rates would reset, some of the foreclosure problems were just totally unavoidable. So we had a sense it was coming, and then I think the actual defaults back in 2007 is when it really started to hit home.
Yeah, you knew it was coming because you study this every day. This is your job. What does it do, though, to the people of Stockton when they wake up in the mornings and they see the foreclosure numbers or they drive down the street and they see the foreclosed homes?
The impacts are obvious. There are neighborhoods that are highly impacted in terms of vacant homes right now. Certainly that brings down property values in those areas. I think probably the overall percentage in terms of foreclosed units to the number of total housing units in Stockton is somewhat relatively low. But it does obviously dampen people's perceptions. Nobody likes to be classified as a high foreclosure area, and Stockton, as you're aware, has been, for various statistical purposes, been rated, high in the past. But, nobody certainly likes that stigma.
How long have you been working for the city, Mr. Bersani?
20 years.
How much longer do you think it's going to take to turn this thing around, then? You've been around for a while.
With the housing stimulus package, that's certainly going to help if, absent of any federal intervention, I'm not necessarily optimistic over the next couple of years. But again, with this legislation, I am hopeful that it's, certainly not going to solve everything, but I'm hopeful that it is going to at least jumpstart things. I don't anticipate that, at least here in our area, that we will be anywhere back to the activity and or housing prices that we've seen, anytime soon.
Bob Bersani is the interim housing director for the city of Stockton, California. Mr. Bersani, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Hey, do you want the job on a full-time basis, by the way?
Absolutely.
All right, sir. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye.
There were a couple of bright spots on the macroeconomic horizon today. Orders for durable goods rose almost 1% in June. And despite high food and energy prices, one measure of consumer sentiment bounced back from all-time lows last month. Those energy prices, by the way, continued their slide today. Oil slipped below $124 a barrel for the first time in almost 2 months. Crude was down $2.23 today. That didn't make a lick of difference on Capitol Hill, though, where another day in Congress brought another energy stalemate. Democrats in the Senate tried again and failed again with their plan to cut back on speculation in the oil markets. That procedural logjam also brought down a Republican attempt to expand offshore oil production. Which means, with a week to go before the summer recess and then the fall election campaign, the number of energy bills Congress has passed comes to exactly zero. So if $4 gas and oil at 100 and a quarter isn't enough of a crisis to get them going, what is? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
An NBC Wall Street Journal poll out today shows that the cost of energy is now the number one economic concern for voters. So why is Congress debating legislation most experts call nothing more than symbolic? Easy, says Fred Sharp with the energy think tank Resources for the Future.
They can say I did something, I was for something, even though it doesn't even become law.
And Sharp should know. He spent 2 decades in Congress as an Indiana representative. But he says before you judge how Congress is or isn't responding to the energy crisis, you have to ask another question. How do you define it?
For some, the crisis is that we've got to get moving into a low-carbon future in order to avoid dramatic climate change. The second is, it's just a matter of I'm paying more at the gasoline pump, and this comes at a very ugly and inconvenient time for a lot of people.
Sharp says if getting people off of fossil fuels and onto renewable energy sources is the priority, then high gas prices are actually a good thing. But saying that would be political suicide. So Congress continues to treat the cost of gas the same way it treats the housing crunch, as something it can fix. Energy expert Daniel Yergin says that's misleading.
You can't do the same kind of thing you can do on housing and energy because you're talking about a global system of which we're part. And in which the lead times are quite long.
Yergin says boosting supplies might help in the long term, but he says the fastest way to ease gas prices today is to address the demand side. And that's already happening, just not in the halls of Congress. Yergin says as U.S. consumers adapt to higher prices, national demand for gasoline has already dropped about 3% this year. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The major indices moved mostly sideways today. We will have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. It's a Friday in the middle of the summertime, so let's take a detour for a minute into something a little less weighty than energy prices and home foreclosure, shall we? How about comic books? If you've ever watched The Simpsons on TV, you know the neighborhood comic book store there is a dingy, low-rent place run by a pasty-looking guy who sounds like this.
I've spent my entire life doing nothing but collecting comic books.
Life well spent!
Easy talk coming from a cartoon character, I know, but there's an element of revenge of the nerds here, because comic book stores are hot. Unlike a lot of book retailers, comic stores have actually managed to increase their business the past couple of years. One of the ways they've done that is to become more than just stores. Meltdown Comics here in Los Angeles has a gallery space for art. It hosts special events to draw customers in, too. Like an open mic night this past Wednesday with stand-up comics talking about comics.
Batman, he doesn't really find much funny, and I don't blame him. He's been through a lot. I think the one thing that Batman would find funny, though, would be Superman jokes.
I think a lot of the reason that people like performing here is, oh my God, I never thought I was going to be able to do this joke, and I can.
My name's Matt Todd. I was looking for War Heroes No. 1 by Mark Miller and Tony Harris. I dropped $40. Yeah, this is the second trip of the day.
My name's Linda Pine, and I started buying comic books at places like head shops. And those are creepy places if you're a little girl. This place is like Nirvana if you're a little girl.
Chris Rosa. The stores back maybe 15, 20 years ago had more of a secret clubhouse quality to them, which now is more of an open feel. You don't need to know every member of the Avengers to be able to walk into a store.
Meltdown's main customer base has disposable income now. The people who come to a store like this would rather have these things than a Lexus.
There are going to be 150,000 of that kind of people in San Diego this weekend. The big annual comic conference, Comic-Con it's called, is completely sold out. And among the crowd is going to be Joe Field. He's president of the comic retailers trade group Comics Pro. I asked him whether all the blockbuster movies this summer, there's Hulk, Iron Man, and of course the new Batman flick Dark Knight. I asked him whether they're going to affect sales.
The movies are a great commercial for what comic book retailers have to sell. And so anytime there's a $100 million commercial that's up on the big screen, it does help comic book retailers.
I'm wondering how your business is doing compared to, say, independent bookstores versus the big chains. I mean, do you have those kinds of problems?
There is encroachment into our business from mass market retailers and sales online and that sort of thing. However, there's also a knowledge base among comic book retailers that is so far ahead of anything that any of the large chains could put together that we still feel we're well ahead of the curve in that respect.
We've reached you down in San Diego. You're at the Comic-Con International Festival down there, which is better known, I have to say, for people dressing up in weird costumes than anything substantive coming out of it. Does that give you pause at all?
Oh, well, I would disagree with that statement, Kai. I'd say that there's a lot of substantial things that come out of Comic-Con. There's a lot of business that gets done behind the scenes. And really, what I'd like to relay to your listeners is that comics are the creative genesis of all visual entertainment.
That's a pretty broad statement, Joe.
But it's a completely accurate statement. The panel-to-panel storyboards that begin any of those other ideas in other media, like video games and TV and movies, all begin with comics.
Joe Field runs Flying Color Comics up in Concord, California. He's also the president of Comics Pro. That's a trade group for comic book store owners. We got to him down in San Diego at the Comic-Con conference. Joe, thanks a lot for your time.
Pleasure, Kai.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Johnson, once again, how
are you? Mr. Rezdahl, always good to talk to you. Always, I'm glad you came by today.
I kind of have to. It's my job.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, I'm glad you came by anyway. This week, you know, this week was different. This week probably felt better than it actually was. I was amazed to look and see that the Dow was down for the week. It kind of felt like it was up.
It sort of did. It was a very zeitgeisty kind of thing going on here.
This was an interesting week. I don't know. I still think the last, and maybe we go back a couple of weeks, but I still think we'll look back on the last couple of 3 weeks as sort of the bottoming out of the market. I don't know. That's not to say that it turned around and goes straight up.
You heard it here first, folks. Well, what made you think this week was interesting? I mean, yesterday was certainly no prize.
Well, yesterday was, gosh, you know, that was the thing. Is just when you get all cocky and hear oil prices come down and they start. Some of the stuff was pretty squirrely this week. I mean, I saw a couple of airlines go up 30-40% mm-hmm. one day.
Right.
But yesterday was the thing that kind of brings you back down to earth and lets you realize there's still a lot of concerns out there. And yesterday it was financial stocks more than anything else. And I know the weak housing numbers or whatever else got credit for the sell-off. But I'm telling you, I detected a few moments of real fear in yesterday's market. And I'm not so sure that it was completely out of there today because I saw the financials down.
Yeah.
But there was this obscure – did you see this, to me, very obscure site called GimmeCredit.com,
yeah,
GIMMECredit.com.
Why don't you explain to folks what they did and why it matters?
Well, what they said, they yelled fire in a crowded theater is what they did. They wrote this article. They said, quoting now, "We won't use the phrase run on the bank, but we would be remiss if we did not observe that many creditors have quietly been pulling funds." And they were talking about WaMu, you know, one of the
Washington
big financial
Mutual, which I should point out here is my bank. So I was paying attention to those kinds of things
well,
yesterday.
They saw you in line over there. And Washington Mutual came back and said, you know, this is not
all right.
True.
So it's more of that whole rumor thing that's going on. But it's not like people make this up.
Just,
I mean, financials, there people are worried about the banks.
Well, and that's right. And you know, with the weekend coming up, I could see that we, you know, sell off yesterday and be real quiet today just so we make it through the weekend, or at least all the financial institutions do. But But that was sort of unsettling. So that's still lingering out there. And then there's big corporate America. This Chrysler coming out and saying, you know, we're losing our shirt on leases because people are bringing these SUVs back from leases. And we can't do anything with them. And then GM, you saw GM saying the car sales were no great shakes, you know, for the month. The interesting thing out of GM is in the headline, we'll see how this plays out next week, is GM said that they have found some bidders for the Hummer business.
Oh, is that right? I hadn't seen that.
Yep, and they're going to move very quickly on it. No, that's true. Now, here's my speculation. And if it's true, you remember where you heard it.
Of course.
I think like Olive Garden or somebody else is going to buy these things and turn them into theme restaurants.
David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kai.
All right, you too. Coming up, working on roads less traveled.
You're doing something different. You're seeing something different. An animal, you know, like you might see a bear, you might see a moose.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials nudged up just a tenth of 1%, 21 points to close at 11,370. The NASDAQ gained 1.33%, 30 points to finish at 2310. The S&P 500 climbed 0.4%, 5 points, ended the day and the week at 1257. After what was a volatile week, as Johnson was telling us, both the Dow and the NASDAQ were down 1%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac lost ground again after S&P announced it may cut the company's debt ratings. Freddie gave up more than 6%. Fannie Mae lost almost 4%. Crocs melted down 44% after the company issued a profit warning late yesterday. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. President Bush meets with the Prime Minister of Pakistan in the Oval Office. The National Alliance to End Homelessness opens its annual conference in Washington. And the Summer Olympics opened in Los Angeles on July 28, 1984. And in 2 weeks, the Games kick off in Beijing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. More than 100 years ago, the Canadian government began taking Aboriginal children from their homes and sending them to church-run institutions, what came to be known as Indian residential schools. It was a massive program of forced assimilation that endured until the last school finally closed in 1996. It also resulted in the largest class action lawsuit settlement Canada's ever seen, nearly $2 billion in total compensation for survivors who apply. The settlement was approved almost a year ago, but how far can money go toward healing? That question is at the center of this story from Marketplace's Sean Cole.
It was a very pretty day to say sorry. June 11th, the day Prime Minister Stephen Harper was to formally apologize for governmental efforts to stamp out Native culture in Canada. I went to Parliament Hill in Ottawa 4 hours early looking to talk to survivors of the residential schools. The sun was high and hot, and Nora Martin was sitting at a picnic bench near a crowd of giggling children. She's in her 50s, a member of the Cloquet tribe in British Columbia. And within 2 minutes of meeting me, she said she'd been sexually abused at her school.
And I didn't get my education. And they didn't pay any attention to us. They just let us do what we wanted to do. We could go uptown and buy drugs.
What sort of drug?
Acid.
Martin was 12 years old when a taxi took her to Port Alberni Residential School in British Columbia. She was there for 4 years, graduated with a drug and alcohol problem. She didn't go into rehab until 10 years later. Didn't know she could learn until she took some college courses after that. And while she put in for the settlement claim, she said the money hasn't exactly been part of her healing process.
I don't believe you could put a price on it at all. Like, no amount of money is going to ever help me with what I've gone through.
And most of the survivors I talked to that day said the same thing. But it's complicated. It's not like they were going to say no to the money. And yet any number you come up with after trying to eradicate someone's culture is going to seem arbitrary. In short, there are two kinds of compensation. The first one is open to all residential school survivors, and then you can apply for additional money if you were abused. The fund that's open to everyone offers $10,000 for the first year you attended a school and $3,000 for every additional year.
In my particular case, that I was there for 12 and a half years, I'd be eligible for $46,000.
Did you get all that?
No, I didn't. No.
Mike Kakaji is president of the National Residential School Survivors Society. I caught up with him at his hotel before he took the bus up to Parliament for the apology. He's from the Cree tribe. Actually attended three schools from the time he was 4 years old right up until he was 16.
They still owe me $12,000 because they lost records. Now, you have to go back and remember that these schools ran for 100 and some years. They destroyed a lot of the records, like the attendance records.
By one account, nearly half of the claimants haven't gotten everything they put in for. And they can appeal, but that means actually describing a school or naming who was there. And Kakaji says the process can trigger memories he'd rather not have.
Okay, the first experience I have to do is I have to go back and apply and deal with the trauma that I experienced in residential school.
You mean sort of relive it?
Relive it. Then I have to go through reconsideration, and I have to really get down to specifics. So yeah, you relive it.
He says he'll have to do this 7 or 8 times. But he also says it's hard to be critical. There are more than 80,000 living survivors. The government of Canada's never dealt with anything of this magnitude. About half an hour before Harper's apology, a drum circle starts up outside Parliament. Hundreds of people are settling into folding chairs to watch the address on a massive outdoor screen. Lawrence Hookemaw of the Swampy Cree tribe is one of them. He went to St. Anne's Residential School in northern Ontario, where he says he was physically and sexually abused. He told me how the special compensation for abuse victims works.
What they have is kind of a point system. So, you know, the more abuse, the more money, type of thing. I find it strange, but
I guess I just, how do you decide how much money a certain level of abuse is worth?
Well, you know? That question would have to go to whoever came up with that system.
So I called the people who administer the settlement funds, and they said this system is pretty common. They're not sure how many survivors were abused, but they're planning for more than 12,000 claims, and they say the amounts are comparable to what a Canadian court would award. But don't forget, one of them said, the settlement is more than just a bunch of checks. There's also a South Africa-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission and funding for healing programs and commemoration events, and of course, the apology. And of the 8 survivors I spoke with at Parliament that day, only one of them said the money was more meaningful than the apology. Lawrence Hookemaw, who used his check to get an apartment and get sober and clean up his life.
If I didn't get any money and I had an apology, I would still feel good inside, but what's that going to do me now? The money did help me. Mm-hmm. It's not going to erase everything, but it can make things better.
Still, he did feel gratified when the Prime Minister and all of these other members of Parliament finally appeared on the big screen. In fact, he said, it was more than he expected.
The Government of Canada sincerely apologizes and asks the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly. Nous le regrettons.
I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Nimi Tatenan, Nimi Genoese.
A dip in the pool might be nice this weekend, but if you're yearning to do something different with your time outside, here's another installment of our series, Hot Jobs.
We're having a heat wave.
There are a lot of places in this country where the season for fun in the sun can be kind of short. Colorado is one of them. So to truly enjoy the great outdoors, you might want to hop in a Jeep with this guy.
This trail here to the left is the Mount Antero you was asking about. Is the Mount Antero trail right here.
Okay.
That's a very rough road. Some places the tires riding close to the edge of sheer drops. I've had people cry all the way up there.
My name is Roger Kirby. I'm a tour driver. We've been jeeping for a long time. I have since 1973. Came out here jeeping, and we saw how pretty it was and everything. And we put our minds together and thought, well, this would be a good place to start a Jeep tour company. We'll start around the first week of May, depending on the weather, and we'll go till the last of October, if the weather's good. And if it's good, we'll go into November. We'll get over around 14,000 feet up. That's pretty high. Scenery's awesome. I've never been a big wildflower person or anything, but some of the trails, when the wildflowers come out, they just knock your socks off. They're so pretty. You know, all the different colors are just vibrant. It's amazing to watch the people's faces when you go up, you know, and the expressions they have, you know, and they're the hoo and the nah and saying, wow, this is wonderful, you know, and everything, you know. And some get a little scared, you know. The flatlanders, you know, come out not used to the height and everything. We do a lot of repeat business. Some people that come back and take a tour every season, they'll ask me, where are you from? You know, and I'll tell them, I'm from Nashville, Tennessee. And they'll say, well, we could tell you weren't from here because you kind of got a drawl, they'll tell me. I get tickled about that. And I say, do I sound a little country? They'll say, well, just a little bit. Some people say, don't you get tired of doing these trails every day? No, because you go out every day. Not like working on an assembly line, you know. You do the same thing every single time like that, you know. You're doing something different. You're seeing something different. An animal, you know, like you might see a bear. You might see a moose. Well, I don't work that hard. You saying how hard I work? Actually, it seems like I'm on vacation for a long time. Because what I do, you know, we hear that all the time. Boy, you've got it made.
Megan Verlee from Colorado Public Radio helped us out with that report. You can see a picture of Roger Kirby and his Jeep Scrambler on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, and I'm going to preface this by saying, yeah, it's about Barbie dolls, but don't forget Barbie's a $1 billion-a-year winner for its parent company, Mattel. Anyway, there's been a lawsuit dragging on between Mattel and MGA Entertainment, which makes the Barbie wannabe dolls, Bratz. Mattel claimed copyright infringement, and they won that part of the case last week. But today, a judge has halted the damages testimony phase after a juror was dismissed for making racial slurs against MGA's CEO. He's an Iranian-American. MGA says it's going to ask for a mistrial. Mattel, for its part this afternoon, called the development unfortunate. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 21 points, a 10th percent. The Nasdaq added 30 points, 1 1/3%. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.4% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, bargain shoppers hit the housing market.
I was just speaking with an investor out of California yesterday, and he says the banks are just dumping properties. I mean, it's literally all over the country.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.